This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Felix Leit, CBS News and Moscow Times, reporting on the virus in Russia. Felix, I report to you that in a conversation with Novosibirsk, which is Siberia, a very large industrial town, and with the university town outside, Akademi Gorodok, I learned that there is great concern, unusually great concern, given that I've spoken with Novosibirsk before, of the virus, the Delta virus, what was described to me as a fourth wave. In fact, there was inquiry about my health here in Connecticut. So what I'm understanding is that something has happened to change the profile of the virus. We've reported on it for months that Moscow first with mandates and then backing off from mandates was going to live with the virus. However, something unusual seems to have jumped so that we're setting new records. What can you tell me? Good day to you, Felix.
Good day, John. This isn't just a sort of a Siberia or a Novosibirsk story. You know, the virus is really rearing its head again in Russia right now. You know, and the reasons are still very much sort of the same. You know, Russia, even though vaccines have been sort of more or less freely available for the best part of a year now, vaccine uptake rates are very low. We have about 29% of the adult population vaccinated, which is very, very, very low. In addition to that, you know, we have sort of the eternal question about how accurate or inaccurate the sort of the officially approved statistics are. Now, for a very, very long time, we consistently saw something like 800 deaths every day. And of course that, you know, that called up quite a lot of skepticism from sort of observers, from journalists. And crucially, what's happened now, since the election of last month now, is that those death rates have been spiking up. They were at 800 for a very, very long time. Now they're sort of breaking 900, coming towards even 950 every day. And, you know, a lot of people who were sort of, who expressed doubt that the initial statistics were sort of real, suspect that now the government might be sort of publishing more accurate statistics in order to sort of communicate the gravity of the crisis. You know, coronavirus was not really a subject that the government wanted to talk about during election season. But now with the crisis over, it feels much more free to do so. And what we have now is things like, you know, certain cities, I don't think it's quite Russia-wide yet, are talking about reintroducing, you know, QR code permits for restaurants, going into restaurants. I think massive events, quote unquote, all across the country are banned now. So there is certainly a sense of sort of a renewed urgency in the fight against the virus. And this is really across the whole country, not just in Siberia, although, you know, as a rule, the situation is always worse outside Moscow.
Yes, Novosibirsk is a city, I'm told, of 2 million people, nothing to the scale of Moscow, but a very large city for Siberia with winter coming on. The snow's flying, Felix. So we turn to the story of energy. Now, this doesn't start with Russia this time. This starts with a headline from the Bloomberg. European gas surges 60% in 2 days as EU sounds alarm. Subhead, European industry buckles under a worsening energy crisis. France and Spain call for EU to act on surging gas prices. And everyone is pointing a finger at Russia. So Vladimir Putin is answering. I'm following the reporting at the Moscow Times. Putin blames Europe for gas price crisis. It goes on to say they've made mistakes, Putin said in a televised meeting with Russian energy officials. He said that one of the factors influencing the prices was the termination of, quote, long-term contracts in favor of the spot market. It turned out, and today this is absolutely obvious, that this policy is wrong. So Europe is blaming Putin. Putin is blaming Europe. Right now, the expectation is that it's going to be a chilly winter. What is your analysis of what's going on? Is Putin using his energy superpower to an advantage, or is this the recovery and the supply chain?
Well, it's hard, of course, to know the internal dynamics of gas supply. You know, I certainly won't claim to be an expert in the logistics of supplying natural gas, but you know, it is a fact that Europe is exceptionally dependent on Russian gas. This is continental Europe primarily. It's very dependent on Russian natural gas for its winter fuel, and always has been. And these kind of gas flare-ups have been a very standard sort of feature of the European political and European energy landscape for quite some years now. You know, I certainly remember right back to sort of 2005, 2004, we were talking about sort of Russia strategically shutting off the gas in winter to sort of leverage concessions out of, you know, its sort of partners in Europe. But, you know, this isn't just a sort of a one-way process. You know, it's very easy to sort of overemphasize how sort of dependent Europe is on Russia. But actually, you know, Russia is quite dependent on Europe in the same way too. You know, Russia needs somewhere to sell their gas to, and they've just invested a great amount of money and political capital and energy into securing Nord Stream 2, the pipeline along the bottom of the Black Sea, or the Baltic Sea rather, that will sort of facilitate gas supplies direct to Germany. So I think, you know, these two sides sort of need each other, and they will have to sort of work out a sort of a modus vivendi, a way of sort of keeping things going, both for their own interests. And I think Russia is vulnerable to Europe on that level too. So I suspect we'll see some kind of resolution before the winter sets in.
In a scary and spectacular report at the Moscow Times, I learn of torture at Russian prisons. And it is presented that this is nothing new. This is routine. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think certainly the expert community, the sort of the human rights sort of, you know, observers, human rights experts would sort of argue that, torture, if not torture, then at least brutality is fairly normalized in Russian prisons. I think what this specific leak that's been reported on is different in is that it's sort of provided video evidence and quite graphic and quite, in many cases, quite upsetting video evidence of the levels of sort of abuse and brutality and torture in Russian prisons. The leak was, I think, if I'm not wrong, about 50 gigabytes, which is, you know, a colossal amount of video. And it's really interesting that the reaction has not been sort of to sort of double down and, you know, back up the sort of prison officials. What we've seen is a string of actual regional sort of heads of the penal authority, the Russian sort of state penal authority, actually being sacked over these over this leak. So, you know, as in, you know, these people are being incriminated for having allowed torture on their watch. So I think we've seen the head of the prison authority in at least one region sacked. A number of prison doctors have been sacked as well. So it's, you know, it's stirred up quite a reaction. And, you know, the state is at least keen to demonstrate that it's not allowing this kind of thing. So it's an interesting turn of events, I think.
We have a moment to talk about the Georgia election that you're reporting on. There's been very little reporting of it. Here in the United States, the Georgia ruling party leads the polls. Does this favor Moscow? Is this looking to bring Georgia back under the fold, or is this more alienation with Moscow?
I would say probably the latter. You know, it's very easy to sort of reduce politics in these kind of countries, these sort of former Soviet countries, to sort of, you know, for Russia and against Russia, or for America and against America, when actually it's much more complicated than that. You know, I would say that the current, the current Georgian government is certainly not pro-Russia. If I could, you know, if anything, it's sort of, you know, the general consensus position in Georgian politics is pretty anti-Russia. You know, a confrontation with Russia is a regrettable necessity of Georgian life. You know, there's very little sort of pro-Russian opinion in Georgia. I think that has to be said. On the other hand, you know, the current government's relationship with the West has become a little bit sort of straitened. They've taken on a sort of a very conservative sort of agenda on things like gay rights and women's rights and things like that. So there's been a little bit of tension there. But then, you know, I think, you know, there's a lot of complexity here. And these are real countries, you know, with very complex internal political divides of their own that don't really reduce down to just sort of Russia or America. You know, it's much more complicated than that.
Finally, we get off the planet. There's great news that Russia's making a movie at the ISS. Is this widely reported in Russia? Is there cheering for the idea of an actress being a cosmonaut? We have about a minute.
So I must say, I'm afraid the interest in this has generally been external. You know, I've got had a lot of interest expressed in this story from America, actually, which I think is probably what the Russians wanted in commissioning it. You know, the Russian sort of state has a bit of a film sector. You know, there are regular sort of releases, but, you know, they don't really sort of dominate the headlines. You know, the top movies in Russia are very much the same top movies as in America. You know, Western productions dubbed and subtitled and whatever. And so when you get a sort of a cinematic event like this, it sort of takes the headlines for a bit. And I think that's what they're looking for, you know, to remind the world that Russia is still probably, if not the leading, then a leading space power. And it's sort of, you know, its role on the ISS and its role at Baikonur is very important in sort of the general sort of world space program.
Felix Leit, he is CBS News, Moscow Times as well. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.